All right, so we're diving into some serious legal territory today, folks. Get ready, because we're about to unpack Griswold v. Connecticut.
Ah, Griswold. Now, this one's a real head-scratcher for a lot of people.
You're telling me. It's all about contraceptives back in the 60s, and somehow it leads to this whole right to privacy thing that's not even mentioned in the Constitution.
Yeah, you try explaining that to someone who's never been to law school,
Yeah.
but that's why we're here, right? To break it down and make it make sense.
Exactly. So before we get into the legal gymnastics, can you set the scene for us? What was going on back then that led to this case?
Well, picture this. It's Connecticut in the 1960s, and we've got Estelle Griswold and Dr. Buxton running a Planned Parenthood clinic. They're providing information and contraceptives to married couples.
Sounds pretty straightforward so far. What's the problem?
The problem was Connecticut law. Back then, they had this law banning the use of contraceptives, not just selling them, but actually using them.
Whoa, really? The government was getting involved in people's bedrooms like that.
Yep, that's exactly what was happening. And Griswold and Buxton were like, hold on, this is not right. They were deliberately defying the law to make a point.
That's pretty gutsy. But hold on a sec. I thought this case was about married couples, but weren't Griswold and Buxton themselves not a couple?
You're sharp. That's where things get interesting legally. It brings up this concept of standing. Basically, to challenge a law, you have to be directly affected by it. You can't just go to court because you think a law is dumb.
Makes sense. So, how did Griswold and Buxton even have the right to bring this case if they weren't personally using contraceptives?
Well, the court said that since they were advising and helping married couples use them, they had a close enough relationship to those directly affected by the law. That gave them standing.
Okay, I'm following so far. So, they make it to the Supreme Court, big showdown. What happens next? Did the justices just say, Connecticut, you're wrong, case dismissed?
Not quite. It was a 7-2 decision, and things get really interesting in that majority opinion. Justice Douglas, writing for the majority, basically said, look, the Constitution doesn't say privacy anywhere, but it's implied by other rights.
Imply it. How do you just imply something that's not written down? That sounds a little, I don't know, convenient.
Well, Douglas pointed to things like the First Amendment's right to association, the Fourth Amendment protecting against unreasonable searches, your basic freedoms. He argued that these create a kind of zone of privacy. He called them penumbras.
Penumbras, like as in shadows. Sounds a little poetic for a legal document, don't you think?
It does, but it was a clever way to argue that even though the founders didn't explicitly write down privacy, it's still protected. Imagine it like this. You have a right to travel between states, right?
Yeah, I think I remember that from school. It's not specifically written out, but it's like understood.
Exactly, it's implied. And Douglas used that same logic to say that by banning married couples from using contraceptives, Connecticut was invading their privacy.
Okay, so they struck down the law, and then bam, they just created this whole right to privacy based on like vibes. That seems like a pretty big deal.
A huge deal. And it opened up this whole can of worms about how we interpret the Constitution. Is it a fixed document or does it evolve? Justice Black, in his dissent, made it clear he wasn't buying any of this penumbra business.
Okay, let's talk about that dissent. Black was not a fan, right? What was his deal?
Justice Black was a strict constructionist. He basically said, if it ain't written in the Constitution, it ain't a right. He thought the majority was playing fast and loose with their power. He even wrote, I like my privacy, but the government can invade it unless the Constitution specifically says no.
Wow, he really went there. It sounds like he was worried that by making up a right to privacy, the court was opening up a whole Pandora's box. Like, what's next?
You got it. He thought they were basically inventing laws based on their personal opinions instead of sticking to the Constitution. That's what we call legislating from the bench. He saw it as a power grab.
So we've got this clash of philosophies. Douglas and the majority saying the Constitution evolves, Black saying, nope, stick to the script.
Precisely. And that's what makes Griswold so fascinating. It goes beyond just contraceptives. It's about the core of our legal system. Where do we draw the line between individual freedom and the government?
And it seems like we're still wrestling with that question today. But we've already covered so much ground. I think we need to take a little break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into those other dissenting opinions and see how Griswold's legacy lives on. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground already. We talked about the majority opinion in Griswold, that whole penumbra thing. But what about the other justices who didn't agree? What were they saying?
Well, it's interesting because not everyone who disagreed with the outcome agreed on the why. Take Justice Stewart, for instance. He thought the Connecticut law was, and I quote, uncommonly silly.
Uncommonly silly. I like that. Straight to the point.
Right. But his point was, just because a law is silly doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. He thought that whole penumbra argument went too far, stretching the Constitution too thin.
So even those who didn't like the law weren't totally on board with how the majority got there.
Exactly. It shows how much nuance there was in this case. Even brilliant legal minds looking at the same thing can come to different conclusions.
Reminds you that it's not always black and white. But, okay, what about those who agreed with striking down the law but maybe had different reasons why? Those concurring opinions, what was going on there?
The concurring opinions are where you really see the justices grappling with how to fit privacy into the Constitution. Justice Goldberg, for example, he pointed to the Ninth Amendment. It basically says that just because the Constitution lists certain rights doesn't mean those are the only rights people have.
So, like, hey, just because privacy isn't spelled out doesn't mean we don't have it.
Clever. Right. Justice Harlan focused on the 14th Amendment, you know, due process, protecting individual liberty from the states getting too nosy. And Justice White was concerned about the marital relationship specifically. He argued that Connecticut was butting into something very personal and sacred.
So a lot of different ways of getting to the same conclusion. They all agreed the law was bad, but they had their own takes on why.
Exactly. And that's what makes Griswold so important. It wasn't just about saying yes or no to contraceptives. It kicked off this whole debate about defining and protecting privacy. And that debate, well, it's still going strong today.
And it's had a huge impact on other cases, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people hear Griswold and they think, oh, old case about birth control, but it goes way beyond that.
Absolutely. Griswold laid the foundation for so much that came after. Think Roe v. Wade, for instance.
Now that's a case everyone knows. So how did Griswold lead to Roe v. Wade? Help me connect the dots.
Well, remember that whole idea of a zone of privacy the majority in Griswold was talking about? That concept was central to Roe v. Wade. The court in Roe leaned on Griswold, arguing that this right to privacy also covers a woman's right to choose whether to terminate a pregnancy.
So it's like Griswold built this legal framework and Roe v. Wade just built on top of it, a domino effect.
Exactly. And it didn't stop there. Griswold also influenced other landmark cases like Lawrence v. Texas, striking down sodomy laws, Obergefell v. Hodges, legalizing same-sex marriage. The impact is huge.
Wow. I had no idea how much one case about Connecticut and contraceptives could ripple outward. It sounds like Griswold wasn't just about privacy in a general sense, but really about personal autonomy, the right to make your own choices about your life and your body.
You got it. Griswold really helped to establish that legal protection for individual autonomy, that the government can't just step in whenever it feels like it. And that's had a huge impact, as you said, on everything from reproductive rights to LGBTQ plus rights. It's all connected.
Incredible to think how a case from over 50 years ago can still be so relevant today. These aren't just abstract legal arguments. They affect people's lives in a real way.
Absolutely. And it makes you appreciate the courage of people like Griswold and Buxton, who were willing to stand up and fight for what they believed in, even when it meant getting arrested. Real trailblazers.
For sure. But before we get too far ahead, we still have one more dissenting opinion to talk about, and this one might surprise you.
Ah, yes. Justice Blackmun. He actually went on to author Roe v. Wade, but in Griswold, he dissented. He argued that Connecticut did have a right to regulate morality, at least to some extent.
Wait a minute. The guy who wrote Roe v. Wade was okay with this law restricting contraception. That doesn't add up.
It shows you how complex legal thought can be. Blackmun's views evolved over time, and in Griswold, he argued that the state had a legitimate interest in discouraging premarital sex. He saw the ban on contraceptives as a way to uphold those traditional values.
But the law wasn't just about premarital sex. It was about married couples, too. How did he square that?
He argued that by making contraceptives harder to get in general, the law would also discourage premarital sex indirectly.
That seems like a bit of a stretch, don't you think? Punishing married couples to control the behavior of unmarried people.
It does raise that slippery slope argument we see so often. If the state can restrict one thing for moral reasons, where does it end?
It's a bit unsettling to think about, but fascinating to see how someone with that viewpoint in Griswold could then go on to write Roe v. Wade really shows how a legal mind can change and grow.
Absolutely. The law is a living thing, constantly evolving. It's not just about applying rigid rules. It's about interpreting those rules in the context of society.
Okay, so we've covered the majority, the dissents, even the concurring opinions. We've talked about implied rights and penumbras and how this case about a Connecticut law had this massive ripple effect on so many other areas of law. But before we wrap up, I want to bring it back to our listener. They're prepping a presentation on this way. How can they make this case relevant today? Because let's be honest, a lot of people might think, oh, contraceptives, that's ancient history.
You're right. It's crucial to show that the fight for privacy didn't end with Griswold. In fact, it's become even more complex, more urgent in this digital age we live in.
All right, we're back, and we're ready to wrap up our deep dive into Griswold v. Connecticut. You know, it's amazing how a case that started with contraceptives in the 60s can still feel so relevant today.
It really does, doesn't it? It all comes back to those fundamental questions Griswold raised. You know, where's the line between individual freedom and the government's power? How do we even define privacy in a world that's changing so fast? These aren't just legal issues. They're about who we are as a society.
And you mentioned how the digital age has just blown all this wide open. I mean, we're living in this ocean of data, and it feels like everyone wants a piece of it.
Yeah.
Companies, the government, everyone's tracking us.
It's true. The digital world has created challenges to privacy that the founders probably never even dreamed of. Our online activities, our location, what we buy, it's all being tracked and analyzed. The implications for privacy are huge, and it's a lot to grapple with.
It feels like we're losing control, you know? So how do we even begin to apply the principles of Griswold, a case from way back when, to this digital world we live in now?
Well, I think it starts with understanding that the right to privacy Griswold established isn't just about keeping secrets hidden. It's about autonomy. Mm-hmm. It's about having the right to control our own lives, to make choices about our bodies and our information without someone looking over our shoulder or making those choices for us.
So it's not just about what information is out there, but who has access to it and how they're using it.
Exactly. We need to start setting boundaries. We need to demand that companies are transparent about what data they're collecting and how they're using it. We need stronger laws that actually give us control over our own information. And frankly, we should support those businesses and organizations that actually respect our privacy.
It sounds like you're saying we can't just sit back and be passive.
Yeah.
We have to be informed. We have to be engaged. We have to speak up for our own privacy in this digital world.
Absolutely. And that's where Griswold's legacy is so powerful. It reminds us that we can challenge the status quo, that we can hold those in power accountable, and that we can and should keep fighting for privacy in every aspect of our lives.
It's amazing how a case that seems so specific about contraception could have such a broad impact. It shows how these legal battles can spark bigger conversations, bigger movements, and change how we think about basic rights.
It's a testament to how powerful ideas can be. Griswold reminds us that the fight for privacy, for autonomy, is never really over. It's something we always have to be vigilant about, something we always have to be willing to stand up for.
It's a fight worth having, because ultimately, privacy is about more than just secrets. It's about freedom. It's about dignity. It's about the ability to just live our lives authentically.
Well said. And that's why Griswold v. Connecticut still matters so much today. It's a call to action. It's a reminder that each of us has a role to play in shaping the future of privacy in this rapidly changing world we live in.
So as you're putting together that presentation, remember this. Griswold is more than just a case in a textbook. It's a touchstone for our values. It's a reminder that the fight for privacy is a fight for human dignity. And it's a fight that is far from over. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Griswold v. Connecticut.